This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Angel Hospital in Franklin, North Carolina, delivered about 400 babies last year, but future siblings will not share that birthplace. The Asheville-based Mission Health Hospital System announced this week that it's going to close Angel Hospital's labor and delivery services this summer. It says the maternity ward operates at too high a loss and puts the rest of the hospital in jeopardy. North Carolina rejected Medicaid expansion 4 years ago. Many hospitals lobbied against that move. Is the closure of Angel's maternity ward a casualty of that decision? Blue Ridge Public Radio News Director Matt Bush has been following the story and asking that question and joins me now from Asheville. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Frank. How are you?
I'm doing well. Tell us more about, first of all, what this means now, the decision by Angel to close its maternity ward. Give us a picture of kind of what that is and what happens now to women or people, women having babies in that part of the country.
So there are two hospitals. This was three hospitals, now down to two, where women in this area in the western North Carolina region can have their children. And many of them now will have to come to Mission's main hospital here in Asheville. For people in Franklin and further west where this hospital, where they were able to have give birth before, that's more than an hour drive. Certainly not something any woman in labor is going to want to endure. So they'll have to come all the way to Asheville, or there is another hospital in Silva, which is operated by Mission, one of Mission's competitors, Duke Life Point. They have now set up a sort of an agreement that will allow women who don't want to come all the way to Asheville, who have insurance or have doctors at Mission, to be able to have their children there. But it's a longer drive for a lot of women who will be giving birth in this part of the state.
So what does Mission Health say about why they had to close it?
So at that hospital, the hospital system estimated between it loses them between $1 and $2 million per year having a delivery ward at Angel Medical Center. And Dr. Ronald Paulus, who's the CEO of Mission, said that put healthcare, all the other healthcare that is done at that hospital, in jeopardy because of the loss they had on deliveries. So for them, they felt it would be to keep that hospital open and all the other things they do there, to have deliveries done in Asheville. And again, it was about one baby per day was born at Angel Medical Center last year.
What's been the response in the community to that announcement?
They're furious, to put it mildly. Women don't want to have to drive an extra hour. You can't really blame them to have to go an extra hour to have a child. They're very, very angry with this. A lot of the local officials in Franklin also feel that Mission wasn't consulting with them as much, that they felt this caught them off guard, that this was that this decision was made. Now, the hospital is staying open, and Mission has pledged that they will build a new hospital there, because they said building a new facility to replace Angel Medical Center in Franklin is actually cheaper than renovating the current facility.
What are some of the larger economic and policy issues here? I mean, demographically, where does Angel sit? Who does it serve? And what are some of the big picture issues that we should understand in this story?
So Franklin, the city of Franklin, is about 3,000 people. And this is, again, about an hour west of Asheville. So you're getting into the far reaches of western North Carolina. This hospital sits in, and it serves a very impoverished area. 77%, Mission says, 77% of the people who come to that hospital either use Medicaid, Medicare, or don't pay. And that's higher than an average hospital. And that's the truth in most rural hospitals, that the percentage of people who use Medicaid, Medicare, and no pay is higher. So this is a pretty impoverished area. This is also an area where there's a lot of people also who their yearly income is right above the federal poverty line. And this was a lot of the people that the Affordable Care Act was designed to help with the Medicaid expansion through other things to help them get health insurance. So right now, this is an area that's very, very susceptible to changes in health care and potentially people losing their health care.
Yeah, you talked about ACA, so that's under assault now. We expect to see some kind of changes. We'll talk about the House bill in a minute. But Medicaid expansion was something that could have happened in this state. The Republican-led General Assembly chose not to expand Medicaid. Any sense, Matt, that might have played a part? You're talking about something like 500,000 people left uncovered by the decision not to expand Medicaid. Could that have had an impact on Mission's decision to close the maternity ward?
I asked that question to Dr. Paulus at the press conference where Mission announced its decision. And his response, he said yes.
Well, let's listen, because I know you've got some tape from that. I want to play a clip from that conversation you had with him.
I don't know if I can answer that. We would certainly be a lot better off, and we would have had a different set of information to look at. It's possible that it could have narrowed the loss enough. We don't expect places like Angel Medical Center to generate an income. We didn't get involved to make money. We don't believe there's any hope of making money at Angel Medical Center.
Mission Health CEO Dr. Ronald Paulus talking with Blue Ridge Public Radio News Director Matt Bush. That was a conversation you had with him. Matt, did you get a sense that, in the bigger picture, I mean, this is obviously income that comes to the hospital, but it's a discount, right? I mean, when you get paid by Medicaid, so it's kind of that old joke about, sort of losing a dollar on every shirt, but you make it up in volume. I mean, it's hard to do the kind of math that I guess you've asked him to do in some ways.
Right. But I think the basic sentiment of what he was saying there was it certainly wouldn't have hurt to have that Medicaid expansion to help them deal with the cost. And again, deliveries, it's a big cost to a medical system. Again, they were only doing one per day. In the grand scheme of things, it doesn't seem like it's that much. But to an area like that, it's a very, very big deal. And that's why the response, at least in Franklin and the surrounding counties, that's in Macon County and the surrounding counties there, was one of such disappointment and anger.
Well, let's talk about the get a bigger picture on what that area is like and what healthcare means in that part of the state in Western North Carolina. Dr. Maureen Ben-Davies is a pediatrician, works at McDowell Pediatrics in Marion, North Carolina, also on the board of McDowell. Maureen, welcome to State of Things.
Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Give us a sense. Tell us about the community that you serve in Western North Carolina in terms of the economic situation and how you assess how they're accessing care.
Yeah. McDowell County is a very poor county. It's an aging population. There's not much in-migration. There's no real industry. In fact, I think the largest employer is a manufacturer named Baxter and McDowell Hospital. So, as a hospital, there's a real responsibility to be fiscally responsible and to look at the books in a sustainable way and how you can make programs thrive and the hospital overall thrive and to be an economic driver in the community. And so when you talk about, Medicaid and it being a very significant source of income for a hospital, and when you threaten that source of income for the hospital, it's a big deal.
Well, and as you point out, it's an economic engine. It's not only for the hospital, but the hospital tends to be an economic engine in a place like that for the whole region. And so what you have here by not spending that money is a further degradation of the economy in that area. Money that could have been spent to help economic development
isn't
there. Precisely,
yes.
And what you see, too, we were talking about a maternity ward. This is largely considered wellness care in most cases. But the other impact of failing to expand Medicaid is people who go uninsured go untreated. And that means people don't show up at the hospital until they're very sick, Maureen. Am I right?
That is correct. People who are insecure in health coverage and feeling as though that hospital visit is going to financially devastate them, they wait until the last minute to go to the doctor, to go to the ER. And so when they do wait and they don't get that preventative care that is wrapped up in the Medicaid or the insurance package, then you do see sicker patients who are very costly to care for. And cumulative can really affect a hospital's bottom line.
Right, because now the care becomes much more expensive and the outcome's not always as good. What do people do if they make too much to be on Medicaid but still too little to qualify for subsidies under the current ACA, Maureen?
Then they are uninsured. And they, I see them in clinic. And it's heartbreaking. It's the parent who's got an asthmatic child who comes in first thing in the morning after dealing with a child who's having difficulty breathing all night, but fearful of going to the ER and getting that hospital bill is going to drag them down financially for months. Just the look of, guilt and love in their eyes can be, very heartbreaking, heart-wrenching. you know, medications for asthma are extremely expensive. And so if you are covered, you know, you pay your nice $10 copay. But, you know, when you go to fill your medication out at the CVS and they tell you it's going to be $100 to fill that, you know, inhaler for your child to have well-controlled asthma, then that's a difficult decision people have to make, you know, food or medicine.
When you saw this play out in particular with one little girl who was having an asthma attack, maybe you can tell us that story.
Yeah, so just like I was alluding to, I was in clinic one morning, my outpatient clinic, and a mom brought her, I think she was about 10 years old, her child in first thing in the morning, was at the door waiting for us, and this child was struggling for air. You know, she had been up all night coughing and wheezing, and her mom was underinsured, did not have insurance, had lapsed. And knew that if she'd gone to the ER, she would have gotten that bill in a couple of weeks saying that she owed thousands of dollars for care. And she knew that she was well enough to wait until the morning. So she brought her in and we treated her. And I talked to her about filling out her her controller medication. We, you know, gave her oxygen, gave her albuterol, all those medications to deal with the immediate treatment of the asthmatic flare. But when I went to ask her, you know, so we're going to put her on this medication to keep her on it for months while we control her asthma, she looked at me and said, I can't afford that medication. It cost me $150 to get a 30-day supply. And I was convinced that there was a generic. And I called around to pharmacies. And true enough, you know, uninsured patients are looking at hundreds of dollars of medications. And it's very hard. It's a hard decision to make.
Joining the conversation now is Kaiser Health News senior Washington correspondent Julie Rovner. She reports on healthcare policy around the country. Julie, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I should point out that Kaiser Health News is an editorially independent program of the Kaiser Family Foundation and not affiliated with the health insurance company Kaiser Permanente. Julie, put the state of North Carolina in context. We're talking about rural health care in general. It's a difficult rural hospitals in tough shape anyway. This state, one of those that refused to expand Medicaid, where does North Carolina fit? And tell us what the rest of the picture looks like around the country.
Well, one thing that we should make clear is that pregnant women are eligible for Medicaid up to 200% of poverty in North Carolina. And so that's even higher than the Medicaid expansion would have gone. The Medicaid expansion were for people who didn't fit into any other Medicaid category, but pregnancy was one of the original Medicaid categories. But I think what rural hospitals are seeing is that it's the other patients, the non-pregnant women patients and the non-kids who are usually eligible for Medicaid or the Children's Health Insurance Program, who are, you know, bringing down their margins. The deal that was made when they passed the Affordable Care Act for hospitals in general, rural hospitals in particular, is that we're going to cut your Medicare payments, but in exchange, you're going to get all these newly insured patients, either through Medicaid or through the healthcare exchanges. A couple of things have happened that have hurt that. First of all, we had the Supreme Court rule that the Medicaid expansion was not automatic, and North Carolina, one of the 19 states that hasn't expanded. The other thing is that people went on the exchanges, even people who get insurance, when they go to a hospital, they now have, you know, $5,000 or $7,000 deductibles that they usually can't pay. The hospital provides care, and then the hospital now basically has to eat that deductible. So rural hospitals, which have by and large more people who are either uninsured or on one of the government plans, are just, you know, having an increasingly difficult time making, you know, ends meet, and end up making, you know, hard decisions like the one that this hospital made.
Well, and to be clear again about who is covered and who's not, when you have uninsured patients who might have been covered under Medicaid in another state, we talked about the expense of treating them because they go untreated for so long. That's what a hospital like Angel, I'm guessing, and let me ask you this, Julie, finds that things become much more expensive because of that decision, because of those uncovered patients. And so then when they look at their, we have to cut somewhere now. This is becoming an expense we can no longer bear. And then the maternity ward becomes the thing you cut because it may be the most expensive. I mean, is that what we're seeing here, is a kind of cascade effect?
It is. Yeah. And that really, I mean, that is important, particularly for the hospitals, when people can get no other care and then they end up in the hospital and they don't have insurance and the hospital ends up having to eat it. You can only spread those costs. Remember, rural hospitals tend to have lower patient loads, but they have in many ways the same amount of overhead as any other hospital. They have to be there 24 hours a day. They have to have doctors and nurses and orderlies and aides. And it's very hard when you're, you know, paying patient census is that much smaller to make ends meet.
Dr. Maureen Ben-Davies, have you seen any change in the time? I mean, this is interesting because not expanding Medicaid means there are people who hadn't been getting it and now still won't. So I wonder if you've seen, you can't see so much a change in patient behavior, but in the ways hospitals have responded to this, because there were changes in other coverage and then not the Medicaid expansion that would have followed. So in that 4 years, what changes have you seen in hospital care in the areas that you work?
You know, I will say that in pediatrics, which is the area I specialize in, we've been buffered by the, you know, lack of expansion and so forth from the ACA. A lot of our children are able to be covered by state insurance and SCHIP, and the majority of patients are, of PEDS patients are okay. As far as the hospital is concerned, I can't speak to that in terms of what we've done to kind of buffer and see the changes in there.
Julie Rovner, what about places around the country, states that have expanded Medicaid? Are they doing any better?
Well, there was an interesting study that actually came out of researchers at the University of North Carolina that found that rural hospitals were much more affected by whether a state did or didn't expand Medicaid, that in states that did expand Medicaid, rural hospitals were much more likely to be profitable than states that didn't. So even though Medicaid doesn't pay that much, as we talked about, it is important to the finances of those rural hospitals.
Matt Bush, let me ask you a question, news director at Blue Ridge Public Radio, about, you talked about the community being upset at the closure of the maternity ward at Angel. Are people connecting the dots here? I mean, are they seeing this as the continuation of an ongoing problem in rural health, or is Medicaid expansion any part of the debate here?
At least with the people there, I don't think Medicaid expansion was part of the debate, but I think everybody has seen the problems with, or the issues that rural healthcare faces, and that this is not just, this isn't just happening in Western North Carolina, it's happening in other rural parts of the country. There's been some instances in neighboring Tennessee where this has happened, where hospitals have actually closed, not just, you know, cut services. So this isn't, as part of Medicaid expansion, is maybe necessarily not anything anyone's talking about, but I think maybe it's becoming more and more prevalent, but healthcare is such an issue politically everywhere right now, but very much so in Western North Carolina because of the people that represent this area in Washington, D.C., who are very big players on what's going on there regarding healthcare.
Maureen Ben-Davies, you sit on the board of McDowell Hospital. I wonder what kind of conversations you're having about ways to manage these shortfalls.
It's a very wide discussion. It goes in different areas. We have a huge impact with our behavioral health burden and not having that safety net for patients who have mental health disease in our area being so lacking. We have a huge burden in our ED for patients who are with serious mental health disease coming into the ED for treatment, staying there for long stays because there's nowhere to place them. So we have a lot of activity around trying to reduce length of stay using innovative ways such as telepsych, where we have a psychiatrist actually on a screen trying to treat and triage patients who come in with severe mental health disease. So those are the big costs that kind of come into play when we are dealing with a small hospital with, like you said, low volumes and again the overhead it takes to keep a hospital running in the rural area and standards that we have to meet for different regulations that cost a lot of money for hospitals.
Talking about rural health care in North Carolina and around the country, Dr. Maureen Ben-Davies is a pediatrician at McDowell Hospital. She joined us from Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. Dr. Ben-Davies, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm also joined by Blue Ridge Public Radio News Director Matt Bush and Julie Rovner, the Chief Washington Correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Just ahead, We'll expand the conversation to talk about ACA, its replacement, and again, a look at Medicaid expansion on North Carolina Public Radio. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stasio, talking about health care policy and its effect on rural North Carolina. Still with us, Blue Ridge Public Radio News Director Matt Bush and Kaiser Health News Senior Correspondent, Washington Correspondent Julie Rovner. I want to point out that Kaiser Health News is an editorially independent program of the Kaiser Family Foundation, and neither that service nor the Family Foundation are affiliated with the insurance company, Kaiser Permanente. Joining the conversation now, John Oberlander, a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. John, welcome back.
Thank you.
You heard Julie Rovner talk about research at UNC. I suspect you may have had a part in that. But anyway, to compare, we were talking about Medicaid expansion. I want to get into ACA here in a minute and its replacement. But let's take a look at Medicaid expansion, how it has helped or not those places that have expanded Medicaid and the impact on North Carolina.
There's no question that in the 32 states that have expanded Medicaid, it's made a big difference. Much of the media attention on the Affordable Care Act is on the health insurance marketplaces and the exchanges. But if you look at where most of the coverage gains have been, where we've covered most of the uninsured, it's actually through Medicaid. And so in those 32 states, hospitals are getting more paying patients. They certainly would prefer private insurance over Medicaid. Medicaid is better than no pay. So Medicaid expansion can't solve all of hospitals' problems, particularly in rural areas. There's no question it can help.
And what about ACA now? Let's take a look, because we see the ACA replacement bill passed by the U.S. House. I think there's very little doubt that that bill is actually going to survive in its current form. But let's assume that it did. Can you give us a sense of what impact that bill would have should it become law in the state of North Carolina?
It would be devastating to this state and to every other state. The Republican bill would cut about $900 billion in Medicaid, federal Medicaid spending over 10 years. That's a 25% cut in Medicaid spending. It would have a devastating impact on hospitals in North Carolina, on physicians, and across the country, millions and millions of Americans would lose coverage as a result of it.
Julie Rovner, in your reporting, what's your sense, again, of sort of the response to the House passed bill in medical circles around the country?
Well, you know, certainly medical stakeholders are in a full panic. They're lined up pretty unanimously against this bill, primarily because, as John points out, it would be such a deep cut to Medicaid. And this has been kind of undercovered. Everybody thinks it's just a repeal of the expansion of Medicaid, and it is. It's a phase out of that. But it would also, for the first time, cap the program spending. It's always been an unlimited program. To the extent that states are willing to pay their share, the federal government has been willing to match it. And that would end. Would actually say we will only match it up to a certain point. And that's what would cause, according to the Congressional Budget Office, such a large drop in Medicaid spending. So it's not just hospitals, it's nursing homes and home health care. And, you know, primarily that most Medicaid money actually goes for the small portion of the program who are elderly and disabled, and those would probably be cut too.
Well, John, what about the proposed changes in terms of subsidies and tax credits? That's supposed to make up for some of this, right?
In theory, except those are being cut as well. So on average, the subsidies that people get to buy health insurance under the Affordable Care Act, they would fall by about 50%. And what the Republican plan does is a couple things. One is it changes the Affordable Care Act, gives money to people based on their income, income-related tax credits to buy health insurance if they're uninsured. Under the Republican plan, those tax credits would no longer vary by income. They would be fixed according to age. Some younger people, some healthier people will do well, but lots of other people, including older people, including people who live in rural areas, would pay a lot more. Right before I came over here, I looked up Buncombe County out in western North Carolina in the Asheville area. And if you take somebody who is 40 years old, who makes $30,000 right now, they can buy a health insurance plan for about $2,500 a year on healthcare.gov under the Affordable Care Act. Under the Republican plan, their premiums would go up to about $5,000 a year. And in some parts of the state and for some age groups, people's premiums will increase by $10,000. So really, it's not just the Medicaid expansion. It's also that the subsidies are going to be cut. And the Affordable Care Act's subsidies that it provides people to help them pay for deductibles and co-payments, those cost-sharing reductions, those aren't going to be cut. The House Republican plan would simply eliminate them.
And you talked about, say, somebody making $30,000 a year watching their premium go up to maybe $5,000, so nearly doubling. Meanwhile, if you're making $100,000 a year, your tax credit is like $1,500. Like, not only does this not reduce your cost, you actually get extra money in your pocket.
Well, you do, and we should also not lose sight of the fact that this bill is a huge tax cut for upper-income Americans. So because they're cutting about $900 billion off of Medicaid over a decade, you ask, well, where does that money go? It goes largely to fund a tax cut for Americans who make over $200,000, as well as a tax cut for the health insurance industry. So there may be a more regressive piece of legislation in the last century in American politics. I'm not sure what it is.
Julie Robb, talk about, we've been talking about rural hospitals and the effect on that part of the country. Is there a big difference in how ACA, this new bill, ACHA, would affect urban areas? I mean, do they respond very differently, or is it just a matter of scale and proportion?
Well, I think the important thing is what we were just talking about, how the tax credits would change. Right now, the tax credits, yes, they're tied to income, but they're also tied to the cost of insurance in a particular area. And that's the important thing that would really impact rural areas, where health insurance tends to be, in many cases, more expensive. It's sort of, you know, counterintuitive, but because there are fewer people to spread the risk across, people have to pay more. The tax credits would be flat. So if you're in a place where the insurance is more expensive, you would actually have to pay a larger share of that, which does not happen now under the Affordable Care Act, where you only have to pay a certain percentage of your income no matter where you live. So this would be a huge redistribution, basically from low-cost areas to, or from high-cost areas to low-cost areas.
Matt Bush, news director at Blue Ridge Public Radio. Let's talk about Mark Meadows in that part of the state. He was instrumental in getting this package through the House. He's the leader of the caucus, the conservative caucus, the Freedom Caucus, that helped push this through, a big victory for Donald Trump, a big victory for him. But I wonder how this plays out in that part of the state. Politically, has there been fallout for Mark Meadows?
Not that we have seen thus far. We're obviously a year and a half away from next year's primary election, so we might see more then. But he's in what is considered one of the safest districts for Republicans in the United States. It has one of the highest levels of registered Republicans. Maybe, I think it might actually be the highest of any congressional district in the South. Now, some of that is the way it was redrawn earlier this decade by the legislature, or at the behest of the North Carolina General Assembly, dominated by Republicans, that the district, his district, which is the 11th and the 10th, which is Patrick McHenry, another person who was also very instrumental in getting this bill passed. Buncombe County, which is a very Democratic stronghold, the only one in western North Carolina, including the city of Asheville, was cut in half, essentially. So it makes these two districts very safe for Republicans. So there hasn't been fallout yet. We'll see if this continues into next year, though, because there were some things he was part of the negotiations here that he was very involved in that could have an impact on his constituents.
John Oberlander, you have done a lot of research and, you know, written books on the history of conversations about public policy and health care in this country. And I wonder how this one looks to you. It's a fascinating study in some ways. So much resistance to ACA as it was being debated. It's socialism. It's going to break our budgets. But then it's in place. People are being helped by the millions. And now you can't dislodge it because, oh, goodness, it worked. Rural hospitals are actually making money in places where Medicaid expanded. People are being covered. Talk about this debate over health care and the kind of push and pull that has been really part of the fabric for decades.
This is a debate that's gone on in the United States for a century. Most other rich democracies settled the question long ago, is health care a right? And that fundamental question is still being contested in this country. One way to view the Affordable Care Act is the United States took a giant step towards the principle that all Americans should have access to health insurance. And one way to view the American Health Care Act, or a House Republican bill, is that it takes a giant step backwards from that principle. There is no going back to the status quo ante. And you can see that in the sort of gymnastics that House Republicans had to perform to get this bill through. And you can see it in Republican members, for example, example, in the Senate, such as Senator Portman from Ohio, who come from Republican-governed states that have expanded Medicaid. They don't want to lose that expansion. You hear it in the Republican members who say the president vowed that we would not touch pre-existing conditions. We have a problem with the provision in the House bill that's going to let states opt out and essentially reintroduce insurance discrimination. So the Affordable Care Act has transformed the politics of health care. And yet 7 years after it was enacted, its fate is still uncertain. And we still have that debate over is health care a right? And that debate is being shaped by this deep partisan polarization in this country that extends far beyond health care.
Although, as you suggest, the success of ACA, the limited successes that it has had, has created fracture even in that, in the Republican Party, that can no longer stand monolithically opposed because so many of their constituents have now benefited.
Yes, they have to have something. And what's notable about what they're trying to do right now is since Richard Nixon, really, there's been no Republican president who seriously entertained ambitious health reform. Now that at least they have to talk about something retaining some of these protections, although at the end of the day, the House passed a bill that would cause, according to the Congressional Budget Office, 24 million people to lose health insurance. And then they took selfies afterwards, which is pretty remarkable.
Tell us how this compares to the debate over Medicare.
Well, the debate over Medicare was a controversial debate. It was a long debate. It took almost 15 years to get the program enacted. But once Medicare was in place in 1966, it was settled. There were not serious legal challenges to it. There was no effort to repeal it. It was federally administered, so the states didn't have a role. The Medicare debate ended essentially in 1965. What's extraordinary about the Affordable Care Act and for a social program of this scope that has benefited so many people is that its politics are not settled.
Julie Rovner, talk about the politics a little bit as you cover this story. As we say, there aren't too many commentators out there who would say that the House version is going to survive intact. Give us a sense of what might happen and what's going on now in the Senate and what we might see in terms of some form of change of ACA.
Well, what should have been happening in the Senate is that the two Senate committees that were given the same instructions that the two House committees were given should have been working all along since January on putting together a bill. That would be the Senate Finance Committee, the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. And they haven't been doing that. And sort of quietly, aides say they didn't want to go through a protracted committee process because they weren't sure what would come out the other side. That's where you get this now working group, this 13-member sort of, you know, all-white men working group that says it's going to work to put something together, but there are none of the moderates really on that working group. It started out as an idea by Ted Cruz, who's, you know, from Texas, who's best known for saying no and closing down the government in 2013, saying, well, he wants to come up with something. I think he's trying to play the Mark Meadows role in the Senate, but there are many more moderates in the Senate as a percentage of the caucus than there were in the House. There are 20 Republican senators of the 52 who come from states that expanded Medicaid, and many of them have said very publicly that they're uncomfortable with ending the Medicaid expansion and with capping the Medicaid program. So it's going to be a very tightrope for, you know, the Senate to walk. They can only lose. Democrats are not going to participate in this, so the Republicans can only lose two votes and still be able to pass something, at which point it would only go to conference with the House, and then they'd have to come up with something that can get, you know, 50 votes plus Vice President Pence in the Senate and 218 votes in the House. That's going to be still harder.
Vice President Pence, whose state of Indiana when he was governor, expanded Medicaid. So that's right. Other interesting part of this. John Oberlander, what do you suppose, I mean, what would it look like if you could help the Republicans out in this and come up with a bill that, you know, saves face and also helps the moderates not lose their seats? I mean, is there a way to change? I mean, and everybody agrees that ACA, as it was passed, certainly could use reform. It wasn't perfect out of the box and could use some fixes. Maybe the question is better put that way. What are the fixes to ACA that you see as really improving that program without throwing it out and rewriting it?
You could imagine a bipartisan package of measures that would strengthen and stabilize health reform, and that would include more money to help stabilize those insurance marketplaces, which are in difficulty in a lot of states, with insurers pulling out and the announcement just today about Aetna leaving the exchanges. You can imagine that if you were looking for a compromise, maybe Democrats say, okay, the penalty on larger employers who don't offer coverage and then their workers go and get insurance through exchanges, maybe that's not working. Maybe we can do some things in a bipartisan way to talk about the rising cost of deductibles, which is a huge issue for folks with employer-sponsored coverage. Maybe we can talk about prescription drug costs. Maybe we can do things to make sure that those 4 million children we were talking about uninsured before, there are 4 million uninsured children in this country. In a country this wealthy, that's 4 million too many. Could talk about bipartisan ways to take care of that. So you can come up with certainly a bipartisan agenda to strengthen the Affordable Care Act, to fix some of its problems, and to build off its successes. And in a way, that's what happened with Medicare. After Medicare was enacted, Democrats and Republicans frequently got together in ways to improve the program, both in terms of the benefits and the efficiency. The problem is the two parties are so polarized right now that the debate over health care is an existential debate, and there is no room in the middle. And that's why you see Republicans saying, we have to get rid of Obamacare. It doesn't matter if we're going to de-insure 24 million people. This is an existential debate, and we say no.
What about, and I'm going to go big picture now and take us back to the Medicare debate, because again, it was in the sort of the large ideological scope and swing of this debate had to do with socialism versus capitalism, free enterprise market, all that. Ultimately, what got lost in that debate is that when you spend money on medical care, it gets spent in local communities and redistributed, and used to be called the multiplier effect, never hear it used anymore. Is that lost in this debate as well? How much money doesn't get spent locally because you fail to approve the program?
We should talk about it. We're here in Durham. If we drive from Durham over to Chapel Hill, and you and I did a survey of what have been the businesses that have gone out of business, empty buildings, and who has taken over those buildings, the answer would be the hospitals in this area. Healthcare is amazingly important to North Carolina, incredibly important to the Triangle, incredibly important to rural communities and around the country. It is an economic issue. And when you talk about cutting $900 billion out of Medicaid, it's not just that lots of people are going to lose coverage, they will, not just that they're going to lose access to medical care and have a tremendous sense of financial insecurity. You are going to hurt the economy in the area, in those areas. You're going to hurt the economy in the state. And there is an economic argument for health insurance and for expanding coverage.
I want to thank all of my guests. John Oberlander is a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Julie Rovner, chief Washington correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Matt Bush, Blue Ridge Public Radio News Director. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Norman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.